From 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, it's The Bill. Conversations with entrepreneurs and innovators about their dreams, their triumphs, and their challenges.
Transition. In the summer of 2012, a teacher working with autistic students at South Philadelphia High School realized that with the right approach, she could help her class develop the kind of crucial skills necessary to earn good jobs and transition to independence. Michelle McEwen turned her discoveries into a business that helps other educators prepare students with neurodiverse needs for roles in our technology-driven, highly social workforce. Along the way, Michelle's discovered how to transition her own skill set into marketing and fundraising as she prepares to expand the reach of her company across the country and even around the world. It's the story of digitability, coming up next on The Build.
The Build is made possible with support from 2820 Press, providing business consulting and content strategy services to customer-obsessed companies nationwide. More information at 2820press.com.
It's The Build. I'm Joe Taylor Jr., joined by phone today by Michelle McEwen, who is the founder of Digitability. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Likewise. Give us a rundown of what Digitability does and what you're solving for a pretty diverse array of folks that you work with.
So Digitability is a work-ready program that prepares people with a wide range of cognitive and behavioral needs for the workplace. So we base our program on the idea that more than 75% of all jobs require some degree of technological literacy. Also, our workplaces are highly social in a way that's often intuitive for people who are typically developing. But for individuals who have these unique needs, a lot of this content on workplace behavior or digital literacy needs to be delivered in a really systematic way and an explicit way because of their need for a highly synthesized approach to their education and their learning.
And you came to this point in your career from a background in education. In fact, our production team brought you to my attention because I think you on YouTube, you've got one of the best explanations for the sandwich method of providing feedback that I've ever seen. I'll put that link in the show notes. But
thank
tell
you.
Me about the transition from educator to entrepreneur. What was the point at which you said, I feel like I can do more with this mission if I turn this into a business?
Yeah, well, you know, it's actually interesting because even before becoming a teacher, I was art school. And the things I was studying at the time were concepts like streaming media when there was no YouTube. Or, you know, we were designing a social network for our University of the Arts. Around the same year, I think that Facebook launched, it wasn't really accessible yet. So during this adventure of learning about all this emerging technology, I really felt empowered and really motivated to find ways to introduce media literacy into education. When I became a teacher, I kind of have the same goal, despite working with students who had unique needs, whether, you know, it was an autistic support classroom or another type of special education classroom, I still saw technology being an outlet or a way to help them express themselves and identify kind of their future goals, but also a way to sort of help them develop a portfolio so that they were better positioned for when they were ready to pursue their independence. So it was really, I kind of started with this same mission, but who the audience of this mission really changed once I was actually, you know, an educator in the trenches working with students here in Philadelphia. The transition from being in a classroom, I would say the turning point was when my students entered a regional computer fair. And I always say this wasn't the Special Olympics of computer fairs. It was very rigorous And we were the only special education classroom, let alone an intensive classroom, a classroom of students with intensive needs, to participate. And not only did we participate, but we ended up placing third in the multimedia category. So it was a huge achievement for the students, but it was also a clear demonstration of what's possible when you level the playing field. And it was at that point that certain school district officials sort of took notice, and I started doing more teacher training. I started presenting at conferences, and the more I presented on this model that I had developed as a teacher, the more feedback I would get about there being a need. So I would keep in touch with my old dean at University of the Arts, Neil Kleiman, and he told me that he was spearheading this program called the Corso Center for the Creative Economy, and that I could pitch my idea, which was to scale the model I created in the classroom that seemed to have a really great impact, and I could win $10,000. So I did, and that was really the start of this entrepreneurial journey.
And so thinking about scaling from an idea and a platform to a business, what's the biggest thing that you would say you've learned about making this approach accessible to folks all over, you know, especially moving out of Philadelphia and into a nationwide model? What are some of the challenges you're running into as you're scaling this business?
So being able to scale what I was implementing in my classroom had a number of challenges. The first challenge that was presented was, you know, when you're designing a technology for a population with significant needs, you can't make the same assumptions that you might make when developing a product for, you know, typically developing people. So we knew that we had to have a really explicit interface. There had to be certain rules to interacting with the interface. So I have a background in applied behavior analysis, and we used a lot of those principles in how students would move through the program itself. And to help me design that, I worked with another University of the Arts student who also had a sister that was diagnosed with autism. So we had some personal insight about the behaviors or the nuances that his sister would present with. So he was really able to, design thinking, not making the same assumptions that other designers might. So really just having a clear understanding of who we were designing this product for was really important. So when designing the software, we really wanted to first build something that could stand alone. And that was the first step. Thereafter, we started to understand needs of teachers. I myself was a teacher. As a special education teacher, you're very busy. You don't want one more thing on your plate. So we had to expand what we had developed to make sure that we were filling all the needs of a teacher, not making their life more complicated, but understanding exactly what their needs were in the classroom and how that would translate to having a meaningful impact for the students that were receiving, you know, the intervention of digitability.
And in which ways did some of that teacher feedback shape or challenge some of the assumptions that you had made when you started this process?
The assumptions that I had about what teachers would be prepared to do included not so much the time. I knew that, you know, we never have enough time, but their ability to feel comfortable enough to do the legwork around developing digital literacy for their students. So, for example, we have, you know, a library of, you know, 500 or more video lessons that cover a lot of topic around digital literacy. But early on in our product development, we didn't give them the framework by which they would deliver the video modules. And what we realized was there was an incredible opportunity to not only support the process of teaching digital literacy to their students, but by also helping them deliver behavior modification practices that would then help students be prepared with skills they need to operate in the workplace from an angle of, you know, understanding workplace behavior, communication, collaboration. So kind of understanding some of those barriers really created an opportunity for us to expand our offering in a way that really increased the efficacy of our program overall. Because again, understanding that fidelity is so important, and that it's a key factor in having those outcomes, the efficacy, you know, really seeing that the efficacy of the program is doing what it's designed to do.
Now, coming back a little bit to the second part of the question that I asked earlier, as you are shifting gears over time from delivering this content in person to creating a product around it, what are the things that you've had to learn or do a little bit differently to make the program effectively when you're delivering it in a substantially different way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a lot of what we did was use the same principles of evidence-based practices. That we use the same principles that we use in our program and in the development of the content that we deliver to students to design the implementation model for the teachers. A lot of that is scripted content, using these formulas around behavior modification. It also includes understanding what special education classrooms actually look like. You can't make a lot of assumptions about how organized classrooms might be based on student need. You can walk into a classroom and you will have students with so many different needs on a lot of different levels, whether it's their verbal ability, their receptive language ability, their self-regulation capacity. So if you're a teacher and you have, you know, let's say 10 students, all with so many significantly different needs, it can be really challenging to even implement a single lesson where every single student can participate. Our program understood that, and it understood it very intimately based on my experience, but also going into other classrooms and working with teachers. So we're really unique in that we understand the gamut of needs in special education classrooms, and we have something that meets the needs of every student. So you'll hear a teacher describe her classroom, and she might say, okay, I have one student who, you know, is in ninth grade, but he's on a 12th grade reading level, but he really struggles with anxiety or, you know, social emotional capacity or self-regulation. And at the same time, I have another student with limited expressive and receptive language who points to his answers. And Digitability will have resources to support and accommodate the needs of both of those students to make them work ready.
Now, I want to come back to that concept of work ready, because a lot of entrepreneurs I talk to talk about the talent gap that so many of us face right now. And it sounds like you're making great strides in solving a lot of that by helping a lot of folks, you know, consider populations that may have not been fully prepared or prepared not for the kinds of jobs that we're trying to staff in, especially STEM, technology. But I want to think, coming back to something else I heard you say earlier, in the earlier iterations of the program where you're being approached by school district officials, have you observed that there's still a flow of folks that are approaching you, or have you had to go out and create demand for a program like this?
Yeah, so it's an exciting place to be. I started this journey, we could take it back to 2011, but really it started in college. It's exciting that we're in a time where the culture is really shifting. And neurodiversity is being increasingly embraced in the workplace. So we are at a point where we are so unique in what we do that people are really seeking us out at the state level, and whether it's education, whether it's Department of Labor. We're in a really unique and exciting position to help individuals with neurodiverse needs at scale. So if you look at the current statistics around unemployment, cognitive disabilities, more than, I think, 70 to 80% experience unemployment. Our first graduating cohort, or more than 70% of our first graduating cohort, became employed as a result of their training. So our goal is really, one, it's to prepare more people with neurodiverse needs for the workplace and for modern workplaces. A lot of the work-ready programs are really outdated, or they set the bar low. There's a term called the three Fs, which is food, flour, and filth. And these are sort of the jobs that people go to when considering next steps for people with disabilities. And we have a very different lens in terms of the types of jobs that exist now, that are in demand now, and the skills that you need to become employed in any of those jobs. One of the other really exciting trends, for Fortune 500 companies are embracing disability in the workplace. They found that for the 45 companies they studied that were championing disability inclusion in the workplace, on average, they experienced 28% higher revenue, twice the net income, and a 30% better performance on economic profit margin. And then there's a whole other, list of benefits when you have neurodiversity in the workplace. There's characteristics of people with neurodiverse needs that make them ideal candidates. So again, we've been a little bit ahead of this cultural shift, legislative shift. So we're just in a great position to really be a thought leader in this transformation and also help shape the conversation moving forward and dispel some of the myths and, continue to advocate.
So given that we talk to a lot of entrepreneurs in the show, and in my own career, I speak with a lot of folks in a variety of recruiting capacities. Do you find that there's still a fear? Do you find, what do you think that employers may be afraid of when they start to consider neurodiverse candidates?
I think most people have, a subtle fear about things they're not comfortable with or they don't understand. And, I think in our culture, disability is taboo. Even mental health isn't a topic of conversation. We're not educated on understanding what we feel and how to communicate it or how to self-regulate things that we're processing. In special education, you're very intentional in teaching these things, and you're bringing a greater awareness to these kind of automatic and instinctive processes. People with disabilities are not, special, quote unquote.
So knowing that different communities, especially when stakeholders are involved, are often in silos and they talk about these things in very different ways. Tell me a little bit about what you've learned about how you have to change the way that you speak about this program and your outcomes when you're dealing with different audiences. For instance, the difference between delivering a program or enticing a teacher or an educator versus pitching for funding.
Yes. Yeah, that is such a good question and great insight about this whole process. I'm a huge fan of linguists, and there is a linguist, Michael Agar, who talks about language as being a blueprint for your culture and therefore your consciousness. So if you dissect language enough, you can really understand where people are at and what their kind of worldview or lens, the lens they look through. it's the same when I have conversations with different people in these different silos, right? Education, government, corporate. And listening is really important. It's really important to understand the language that they use, because their language will tell you really where they're at and how, where they're at in sort of the cultural shifts of understanding disability or behavior or cognition. What their biases are sometimes are very clear. So when you listen carefully enough and you kind of understand where people are, or you hear the questions that they're asking, you can almost interpret the real question, the question that's behind the question. And it's the same thing with investors, although that was very intimidating and challenging for me in the beginning, because I didn't have any of the language. And I was intimidated by the fact that I didn't have the language. So while I might have known the answers, I didn't really know how to express it. And I didn't really know how to feel confident about what I did express. And in a lot of ways, that feeling is kind of symbolic to the experience of a person with a disability like autism. You know, you're learning to navigate a world, or you navigate these new experiences, and you may not know the rules yet, or you may not have the language that everybody else is using, whether it's like a social language or if it's a corporate language for that matter. So I'm a huge fan of really listening and thinking critically about where people are, meeting them where they're at, and then seeing if you can kind of push a little bit or see how far they're willing to go out of their comfort zone to change or to make progress.
I think one way to make investors feel comfortable is to show some specific financial results. So tell me a little bit about how you've framed up what success looks like for your company on the financial side. What does your growth curve look like? And how big do you think this can get?
So we're in a really exciting place, because recent legislation has really changed the landscape of creating a system that better prepares people who have been traditionally marginalized from the workforce. And so with both federal legislation and then states also updating their policies with an increased focus on individuals with disabilities, Digitability is positioned in a very unique way in the market. We have a beautiful product that has already demonstrated success. And we spent a lot of time listening to our stakeholders and really understanding the message that we wanted to send and really having the right story to share. So now that we've built that, everything's really falling into place. And, you know, as I talked about before, where, you know, people are reaching out to us at the state level from different government departments, we also have a lot of international interest. You know, whenever people see Digitability's product or we give a demo, we always get kind of the same response is, oh, wow, you know, our staff could use this training, or everybody needs this type of training. So it's true. Fundamentally, the skills that we all require to be independent are similar. How we get there, that process to really mastering those skills, will vary. And the experiences that we have will dictate how strong we're able to, or how we strengthen those skills. So I think with the current shifts in the landscape, both legislatively and culturally, Digitability is a unique program with a really valuable offering. So it's exciting to be in this place. We worked a really long time to get here, and I'm excited for what the future holds.
I think that's a perfect place for us to draw it into a conclusion. Thank you so much, Michelle, for joining us on The Build today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of The Build. Our talent coordinator is Nicole Hubbard. Our production team for this episode included Leah Gruber, Amelia Lohman, and April Smith. Podfly Productions manages our post-production, and our theme music is performed by Arrows and Sound. Our director of operations is Katie Cohen-Zonizer, and our executive producer is Lori Taylor. I'm Joe Taylor Jr.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Build. We hope you'll share this series with your friends and provide us with feedback on the iTunes Store. You can also subscribe to weekly updates and learn more about upcoming guests by visiting our show page at thebuild.biz. This has been a 2820 radio production.